into supplying the other half. Glass sensed that the Inquisition guards Melchior and Sarah, who rotated from duty atop the carriage to duty beside her, would have liked to join in too. But Brother Pelter, whilst not following the stricture himself, had made it clear that nobody was to talk to the prisoner. And so Glass was left with only Brother Pelter to speak to. She found the man to be almost exactly what her research had indicated him to be. Ambitious, focused, easily flattered, and whilst deeply versed in the points of heresy on which most Inquisition trials hinge, his knowledge of the faith in a broader sense would not compete with that of any novice that Sister Wheel had passed as fit to move up to Grey Class.
"Do you know who the Inquisition's prime instigator was when I was High Inquisitor, brother?"
Glass lifted her voice above the clatter of the wheels and the drumming of rain on the carriage roof.
"No."
The Inquisitor frowned, as if his ignorance on the matter bothered him.
"There wasn't one," Glass said. "The last holder of the office was Jutikar, cousin to our current Emperor's grandfather. Jutikar died holding the title. According to Inquisition records, he attended 3 meetings in 36 years, although he was quite irregular at executions."
"Why are you telling me this?"
Pelter fixed Glass with those eyes of his, perhaps his greatest asset, holding as they did something truly chilling, usually only to be found in the reflection of a brittle blue sky in deep ice. Glass shrugged.
"By my reckoning, we'll be at Shazal's palace sometime the day after tomorrow. So the office of Prime Instigator seems at least topical. It was a paper title, you see. An invention to please some emperor of long ago. An office meant for royalty, so that the crown could feel, if not a sense of ownership, at least some illusion of control of the Inquisition, and some more solid feeling that it could not be wielded against them. The raft of regulations protecting emperors and their siblings from the sharp edge of the Inquisition was part and parcel of it, similar to those laws protecting High Inquisitors."
"And former High Inquisitors?"
Brother Pelter took on a sour look, reminded of the fact that such details had him crossing half the Empire rather than hauling the Abbess the 5 miles from Sweet Mercy to the Tower of Inquiry.
"Well, we can hardly make such a fuss about heresy, which is after all the business of following the details of the faith, if we're not prepared to follow our own rules elsewhere. Can we, brother?"
Glass smiled.
"If you're happy to set hot irons to a man to establish the degree of his piety, then at least you can endure a few days' ride to ensure you yourself follow the letter of the law."
"You'd do well to practice your penitence, Abbess."
In the light slanting through the carriage shutters, Pelter's pockmarked face took on a somewhat monstrous aspect.
"It's over for you and your convent. The Lancers will have what they want. You should apply yourself to the question of what state you will be in at the end of it. Ashes, perhaps. Shazal is fond of burnings, not as a spectacle, but as a neat end to problems."
"Does High Inquisitor Gemmon know what you've done yet, brother?"
Glass ignored the threat.
"Did any part of this come from his desk? Does the tower even know where you're headed? Or was this all Shazal's bidding? The prime instigator. The office is well named for her."
"I've indulged you on this journey, Abbess, but you will speak of the Emperor's sister with respect. Hers is the voice the Inquisition listens to. Gemmon's time is coming to an end."
"He didn't sanction my arrest, did he?"
"Shazal's sanction is sufficient."
"So, Gemmon hasn't sent any senior inquisitors for this trial I'm supposed to have. There should be 3 judges. I hope you're not thinking to adjudicate, brother. You're neither senior nor threefold."
"Shazal isn't about to let Gemmon send his favorites."
Pelter smoothed down the gray tufts of his hair, a nervous habit.
"We will recruit inquisitors of the required rank and number from the environs."
"Environs?"
Glass asked. Brother Pelter glowered at her.
Oh, Glass said. You mean you'll be picking my jury up along the way?
Pelter gripped the seat, thrusting his face towards her.
We will present ourselves to the Honorable Shirzal with a trio of Senior Inquisitors, Abbess. And when they put you to the question, it will be me who employs the iron, be it sharp or hot, to discover the truth. So you would do well to rid yourself of any hint of mockery.
Abbess Glass pressed herself back, away from the fierceness of the man's face and the rank cloud of his breath.
Of course, brother.
As night fell, Pelter had the carriage put in at Traytown, a settlement of modest size, perhaps 500 homes, many dependent upon the tin mines for a living. The place boasted a church of the ancestor considerably larger than most such towns could afford, and was able to provide lodgings for the Inquisitor and his guards, along with a penitent cell for the abbess. Come morning, the local priest unlocked Glass's door, and she bore his disapproval as the yawning guards escorted her to the carriage.
We're making a diversion today.
Brother Pelter handed her the prisoner ration, a brick of black bread that was supposed to last the day.
Indeed.
Glass accepted the bread into her chained hands. She had been tightening the rope on her habit daily. If the journey had been all the way to the Empire's old boundary out in the Alden, she might have arrived with the figure she had had at 20, though she wouldn't have counted it a good exchange for all those hungry days.
Where to? The shrine at Penrost,
Pelter said.
I had Melchior and Sarah do a little investigating around town last night. It seems that the Inquisition is following reports of heresy at the shrine, an investigation led by senior inquisitors.
Who will be useful in judging at my trial, Glass supplied.
As I said, from the environs,
Pelter nodded.
And who is leading this inquiry? Brother Seldom and Sister Adjica. Friends of yours, I believe.
Pelter allowed himself a narrow smile. Abbess Glass folded her hands across her diminished belly and pressed her lips into a thin line. Seldom and Adjica had been trusted subordinates during most of her tenure in the Inquisition's highest seat. But the estrangement that had preceded the announcement of her departure had been the talk of the tower, and famously bitter.
It's when your power is taken or given away that you discover who your friends are, brother. There's a lesson for us all in that.
They reached the shrine by noon. From a distance, Penrass looked like a toy discarded by some lordling child. A silver cylinder rising from the broken hilltop at a drunken angle, 30 yards tall, maybe 20 yards across. Its walls were a yard thick, a weight of silver steel that to purchase would beggar empires greater than the one it stood in. Except no fire could melt the stuff. No blade could cut it. Abbess Glass had it on good account that an arc steel blade couldn't scratch the mirrored surface. And so, by having the properties so valued in arc steel, but to an even greater degree, the thing moved from priceless resource to worthless curiosity. Steps led down into the underchambers via a tunnel hewn into the bedrock. Until the Church of the Ancestor took the site over, it had been claimed by the small folk that the missing had fashioned the tower, or the Titan's Ring, as they called it. Now the official line was that the tribes had brought it with them from the stars.
You'll come with me, Abbess.
Pelter gestured her down from the carriage.
The face of an old friend will help motivate the Inquisitors to step up and do their duty.
Abbess Glass, with Sarah to steady her, emerged into the cold bluster of the day. After a short transit huddled against the wind, the three of them escaped into shelter again, now bowed over to avoid scraping their heads as they descended the steep, rocky stairs. The missing, or whichever of the four tribes built the place, had not bothered with building material. The walls were either bedrock, sheared away with miraculous precision, or the soil itself, fused into a smooth marble-like substance as hard as stone. Whatever inquiry had been underway appeared to be in the end stages. The Inquisition guards on duty had a bored look. Inquisitors Seldom and Agica were not among those who favored the more brutal methods of extracting information. Agica was a Marjal Touch, with a gift for coaxing the truth off unwilling tongues, and Seldom had come to Glass's way of thinking on the subject of interrogation, namely that the information came more swiftly and more accurately if the questions were presented as a concerned attempt to reduce the subject's final punishment. Glass waited with Sarah, while Brother Pelter went to speak to the Inquisitors. Sarah quickly fell into conversation with other guards at the doorway, men she had not seen in months, leaving Glass to twiddle her thumbs or study the room. The chamber held benches for the faithful during services or contemplation, or whatever it was they did at the shrine. Of the original occupants, though, there were no signs remaining save for one symbol carved into the glassy surface of the rear wall. To Glass's eye it had much in common with sigil work, though it didn't twist the mind as sigils did. If the marking held any magic, it was of a deeper kind, too deep for Glass to touch. Glass was tracing the symbol's curves with a finger when another guard arrived and thrust a peasant into the room. At the doorway, Sarah looked up, then returned to her conversation. Glass had the room's only lamp in one hand, using it to illuminate the symbol. She abandoned her inspection and crossed over to the new arrival. The young man looked worried enough without being left in the dark. "Sit. Conserve your energy." Glass gestured to the nearest bench. The man gave her a look as blank as it was scared. Glass rephrased. "Sit. You need to rest." "Thank you, sister." The man slumped in the wooden pew. His jerkin looked to be made of sackcloth and mud. He had dirt along both cheekbones and smelled of pigs. "I don't understand what I've done." Glass took a seat and made a smile for him. "Perhaps you've done nothing." "I don't understand." The man shook his head, looking at his knees. "In my uncle's village, the old men leave the first cut of the harvest for the corn god. I heard they have a stone church to the Hope down in Whittle." "Why are they arresting people here?" "The ancestors' own children."
"For what?"
"They took Master Root. Said he was reciting the ancestor prayer wrong."
"And the rector?"
"They took him, too. Because he said this place was here when the tribes came."
"It's madness."
Glass shook her head. It was a confusion she had heard many times before, most often at the edges of the Empire. "The greatest threat to any faith is not other faiths or beliefs, but the corruption and division of its own message. When the Dernish sail on us beneath their banners, we band together and become strong. Nobody begins to wonder if they should worship Orm or Guitar or the triple-headed goddess. But when we're left to our own devices, not long before someone, often greedy for power and influence, takes it upon themselves to change the ancestors' teachings, just a little bit, but in a way that makes that person more important or special, or allows them privilege. And before you know it, you have four different churches, four high priests at war, a legion of archons arguing. This has happened time and again. More blood has watered our fields as a consequence of such internecine wars." She stopped, seeing the man's incomprehension. "We present more of a danger to ourselves than do the Derns or the Scythrol. And even the Scythrol wars can be said to have been over interpretations of the faith."
"But in my uncle's village..."
"The ice closes, and it brings together many people and many faiths. The Emperor has sanctioned the Hope Church. Its holy texts are about the future and do not dispute the ancestors' teachings. The Ancestors' Church itself has declared that those who follow the small gods may do so unmolested in the more remote corners of the Empire. Only in the cities and those towns declared as church towns is such practice forbidden. She raised a hand to deflect the next question on his lips. The thing for you to do is wait, and see whether the clerics who taught at this shrine have been found guilty of heresy. Answer any question truthfully. If it turns out that they are guilty, and that you were part of their flock, then you must do the penitence placed upon you, and attend a sanctioned church to learn the true teaching. After that you will be without taint, and of no further interest to the Inquisition. Glass had given that speech, or one similar, an untold number of times. She had repeated it so often like that, like a word repeated again and again. It had lost its meaning for her. In the end, she saw only the immediate consequences, the victims in the here and the now, rather than those postulated casualties from the wars of a divided church. She had begun to lose heart for the work before her boy died. And when Abel choked out the last of his life before her, her heart had broken entirely. She had never returned to the Tower of Inquiry. New figures arrived with lanterns at the doorway, and Sarah gestured for Glass to approach. Glass got to her feet, aided by the peasant, who for the first time noticed the chains around her wrists. "Thank you, sister," he said, gaze still held by the silver chain. Brother Pelter bustled into the room. At his shoulder stood the hawk-like Seldom and the slender Adjica, dark-eyed and skeptical.
"The senior inquisitors have agreed to accompany us to Shazal's palace, Abbess."
He rubbed his hands together, unable to contain his enthusiasm. Glass acknowledged the inquisitors with a curt nod and turned back towards the field worker. "Remember what I've told you, young man. Honesty and penitence." She glanced towards the waiting inquisitors. "You'll be fine." She meant it, too. He likely would be. Of her own prospects, she was far less certain. Chapter 33 Zoe ran beside Kettle, the Noiguan's blackskin hanging from her hand, twisting strangely as though it were a live thing. "We have to lose ourselves." The tunnel ahead held Kettle's attention. The most obvious of the side passages had been blocked off, but any cave system is riddled with fissures and holes. "The lost are hard to find." They ran another 50 yards, Kettle slowing to investigate an opening low in the wall. 2 days and 2 nights. Then we make our move."
"We should separate," Zol said.
Her left hand bristled with cross-knives stolen from the dead assassin.
"We should not."
Kettle abandoned the narrow opening and moved on, veering down the smaller fork where the passage split.
"You're in my care, novice, and how would I find you again?"
"I found you before. I can do it again. I will make a diversion. You can rescue Nona."
"This is the Tetragoad, Zoe. The Tetragoad? You're a novice. You shouldn't be here. Neither should I."
Kettle took a right turn down a narrow passage, delving steeply into the mountain's depths. The floor fell in uneven, muddy steps, a steady trickle of water spilling down them.
"I am the chosen one."
Zoe stopped by a fissure in the wall, a vertical slot wide enough for an arm, but not a shoulder.
"That is what they say. So either have faith in me, or stop worrying. If the Argatha's prophecy is a piece of nonsense, then I am just a child from the ice, of no particular value."
She reached into the crack beside her, the nitra-caked walls scraping her arm.
"You're of particular value, chosen or not.
Kettle clasped the girl's shoulder, knowing anything more affectionate would unsettle her. Zol twisted her mouth into an almost smile. Her hand was empty now, the black skin and cross knives stowed away. She slid deeper into the crack and laid her palm against the rock where it gripped her. "Worry about yourself, sister. And Nona." Her brow furrowed, and with obvious effort she pushed. And somehow, the rock moved. The whole fissure widened, the wall bulging to accommodate the displaced volume as if the whole thing were semi-liquid.
"How?"
"Yisht was my mentor." Zol eased her way into the crack. The blood began to trickle from her left nostril again as she taxed her powers. "And there is a ship heart in this place. Can you not feel it?"
Kettle thought for a moment. She felt nothing specific, but it was true that she saw through the utter darkness of the caves with greater clarity than she had experienced before. And prior to Yisht's theft of the Sweet Mercy's ship heart, Kettle's shadow working had always improved when she neared the vault in which it was kept.
"Be careful!"
she called after Zol.
"They will not find me."
The fissure narrowed, rock groaning, as the novice moved from sight.
"I will find them. Watch for traps!"
Kettle stared at the crack, unremarkable now, with only a handful of fractures to mark Zol's passage. She wanted to call her back. Whatever her talents, however chosen she might be, she was still only a girl, a novice. And this was the Tetragode, a place where the most battle legendary of the Grey would fear to walk. Sister Cloud had done battle with Noiguin centuries ago and barely escaped with her life. Kettle had accepted when she understood her destination that she would not be coming back. She found it harder to accept the same for Zol or Nona.
"Ancestor, watch over you,"
a whisper. And with throwing stars in hand, Kettle carried on down the slippery descent. Ever since Apple had pushed Kettle partway into the dark world to save her life, Kettle had felt the shadow as something fluid, alive almost. Every shadow worker experiences some element of that sensation, but for those steeped in shadow, it was more intimate, more real. The darkness was something that flowed through you, blotted into your skin, ran in your veins. In the depths of the Tetragode, Kettle could feel the Noiguin's web of shadow links all around her, alarms pulsing from one to the other. And something more, something dark and awful, like a spider lurking in the midst of that web. Some many-legged monstrosity ready to scurry out to devour any foreign body trapped in its strands. Something singular, in charge. Kettle continued to go deeper, taking care to leave as few traces of her passing as possible, choosing the narrow paths over the broad, winding her way down among the roots of the mountains. She wrapped herself in the clarity trance, filling every detail with meaning. Twice she found traps, the first barbed and rusty blades anchored beneath the soft mud, covering an area of tunnel floor, the second a fall of rocks, ready to drop at the tug of a thin, black chain that crossed the stony ground. They marked the limits of the Noiguin territory, designed to thwart infiltration via any of the unknown ways snaking beneath the grampains. There are times to attack fast and relentlessly, allowing your foe no moment to regroup, but that is a tactic best suited to a place you know well or have studied in diagrams to the point at which you could navigate it blind. Having rung the Tetragode's doorbell, the best policy, the one Sister Apple would suggest from her study of the Grey Tomes, was to lie low, let the defenders expose and exhaust themselves, and then to learn what needed to be learned before striking and striking hard. The waiting game is a difficult one, especially when a friend is in danger. The Noiguin would not know that Nona was the target of the intrusion. They had many enemies after all.
but she would be high on the list of reasons for the attack. Probably they would move Nona, maybe even kill her and be done with it. Kettle didn't think so, though. If they thought Nona the target, then Nona was also the bait. The Noiguan were vengeful. And even if they were not vengeful, an attack on the Tetragoad was an attack on their reputation and could not be allowed to go unpunished. If Nona were killed, then perhaps the attackers would melt away, uncaught, and that could not be permitted. Kettle thought that the most probable course of action for the Noiguan, if they believed Nona to be the likely target, would be to torture her in the hope of drawing the attackers out. They would consider the possibility that she was threadbound to at least one of her would-be saviors. The only other alternative would be to accept that the Noiguan who had brought her in had allowed herself to be tracked to the Tetragoad by more conventional means, and that was unthinkable. Kettle settled herself deep at the end of a chain of choices committed to memory, and waited. She crouched in the chill, utter darkness of a passage where perhaps no person had ever been before in all the long millennia since the stream that carved it had found a different course. She wrapped herself in clarity, ears open to the smallest suggestion of sound, her mind touching the darkness, sensitive to any vibration that a shadow worker's power might cause. She ate, chewing slowly on the trail biscuit from her pack, letting the moments slide by and accumulate into hours. And Nona, summoned along the thread bond by the terror that Kettle had experienced approaching the Tetragoad, albeit suppressed and channeled into more useful forms by her training, now found her grip on the nun's perception slipping. As fear mellowed into calm, and boredom became the most immediate threat, Nona's place in the back of Kettle's mind became smaller and smaller. At the last she began to feel the cold of her cell and the shivering of her own flesh, which, unlike Kettle's, was wrapped in nothing but the torn remnants of a smock. Nona's eyes snapped open.
Damn!
What? Where were you?
Keot burned across her throat just below the collar.
With Kettle. She's here with Zol. They killed a Noiguan, and now they're hiding. Kettle thinks the other Noiguan will torture me to bring her and Zol into the open.
You had better escape, then.
Nona uncurled, finding her muscles stiff, her arm and hip sore from supporting her on the stone floor. She stood and faced the wall, feeling for the iron pin that secured the chain leading from her ankle cuff. She didn't know if the winding trick had worked, or even if it could work. But it was all she had. With every ounce of the speed at her disposal, she repeated the process, winding the chain around the pin so fast that the disc she built against the wall had no time to collapse. At the last circuit, she gripped the outer edge before the links could shift and applied all her strength to turning it.
Nothing.
Just a double handful of chain dangling from scraped fingers.
Again!
Keot flowed across her skin, trying to reach her right hand, but finding himself blocked by the wristband. Nona tried again. And again. She lost count of her efforts. Any Hunska, even a full-blood, tires quickly when using their speed at its limit. Eventually, Nona slumped on the floor, exhausted, her fingernails splintered, hands sore. She lay, reaching for her serenity trance. Waiting, while her body gathered its resources for more bursts of speed. She heard people approaching, many of them, on soft feet. Her serenity shielded her from the jolt of shock, but the fear still rose, a tide of it. She gained her feet and prepared to fight. The door remained closed. Nona heard the newcomers arrange themselves outside her cell, exchanging a muttered comment or two. And then, nothing. Kettle was half right, perhaps. The Noiguan were ready for any attempt to free her, but not ready to hurt her. Not yet. Their reticence made little sense to Nona. What were they waiting for?
Talasa could claim the kill that had been denied her for so long. She could do it before her peers. If she wanted to torment Nona, she could do that too. Why wait? Nona sniffed at the water they'd left her, stale stuff in a mud clay jug. If she broke it, the pieces would be too brittle to serve as weapons, too crumbly to bear any edge that might cut an enemy or even her own wrists. The water might be laced with drugs, but if she didn't continue to drink it, she wouldn't be much use. She took a sip and returned to her battle against the pin. Hours passed, many of them, perhaps days. The guards outside changed shifts. Nona snatched fitful sleep. Her stomach growled, and true hunger, her childhood friend, returned to her for the first time in years. Nona wound her chain 100 times, tried 100 times to twist the pin to the left or right. The iron resisted her. The bang that hauled Nona from the dark confusion of her dreams was the cell door being thrown open. Light streamed in, more light than Nona remembered being in the world. She flung up her arms, screwing her eyes tight behind them.
"Ice, it stinks in here!"
A man's voice, cultured and full of good humor. Nona sat up and squinted through weeping eyes at the dazzle of light. It came from a single lantern, held aloft by a tall figure. 2 figures, one portly, one slim, stood beside that one, and robed lightless stood to both sides, perhaps 4 of them, more filing in. Nona pulled the scraps of her smock around her and retreated on her backside into a corner.
"And this animal, rotting here amongst her own sewage, killed my Raymel."
The humor left the man's voice.
"Lano, is it her?"
The slim figure leaned in, a dark-haired man in fine clothing.
"It's her, father."
"She is yours, my lord."
The woman holding the lantern wore a black-skin face mask, a Noiguan. A belt laden with cross knives hung over her shoulder, down to the opposite hip.
"You may dispose of her as you wish. My contract has been fulfilled. The Tetragode regrets the delay."
Nona knew the 2 men, though she couldn't see them clearly yet. She smeared away the tears that the light had filled her eyes with.
"It was not well done,"
Thurn's voice narrowed to sharpness.
"But at least it has been done."
He stepped back.
"Secure her."
And the lightless surged forward. Still half blind, Nona tried to stand, but the Noiguan that Nona now knew must be Talasa hooked a foot into a loop of the chain and jerked Nona's feet from under her. The lightless had her a moment later. They were not unskilled, having been trained for years in the Noiguan arts, and all of them had at least a touch of Hunska. Nona broke someone's wrist and struck an unguarded throat, but dazzled, chained, and fresh from sleep, she couldn't fight them off. 4 lightless pinned Nona to the stone floor. The 2 injured retreated, and Thurin Taxis crouched over her, his son Lano, lean, dark, watching hungrily over his shoulder. Talasa held a long, thin cane tipped with a needle towards Nona. The Noiguan kept the needlepoint hovering about 18 inches above Nona's hip, ready to jab her should she somehow start to break free, presumably with a fast-acting poison. Nona stopped struggling and stared at the red, bearded face of the old man hunkered down beside her. A sister of discretion on a mission in which capture is likely often conceals 2 things in her mouth. First, a wax tablet of crail root powder, secured below the gum. Crail root stops the heart. It's not painless, but it is swift. And second, requiring great skill to use, a needle in a leather tube. It's not possible to spit the needle without poisoning yourself,
but anyone it hits will suffer the same fate. The needles are coated with shamon, a venom milked from eels that feed at the bottom of ocean trenches, only accessible from rare spots where warm upwelling water melts holes in the ice. Shamon brings about a slow death. The victims bleed into their lungs and suffer nightmare hallucinations. Most of the poisons the Grey Sisters use are chosen for swiftness. Shamon is not swift, but unlike many of the faster toxins, it has no antidote. Nona would happily have spat such a needle if she had one.
I have a party to attend, Nona. A very important gathering filled with very important people. And I really must show my face, but I will be back to see you later.
He took something from the pocket of his jacket, a disc of black iron maybe 4 inches across and almost an inch thick, set with raised sigils around the edge, one side having a leather cover held in place by a strap. Thurintaxis removed the cover with care, revealing a spiraling set of sigils, each like a twisted spider. Something deeply unwholesome in the way they held the eye and seemed to writhe.
This is the harm. It has been in my family for generations. The pain it causes is said to be unsurpassed. Worse than burning or acid. Worse than any venom. And it doesn't leave a mark.
Thurin held the device above Nona's stomach. He frowned.
It's very effective, but I've never really enjoyed it. Pain should leave a mark. Pain should be ugly and irreversible. So when I come back from mingling with lords and ladies, the highest of the Sis, when I'm done with the wonderful music, the exquisite food, conversing with my peers, I will return to this cell and hurt you in more primitive and more satisfying ways. We will start with cutting pieces off you. Everything it won't kill you to lose. For now, though...
A shrug, and he pressed the iron disc down onto Nona's stomach. Pain filled her, spreading rapidly from the contact site. It felt as if the disc were red-hot, flowing out to cover her entirely. Somehow it combined the first awful shock of a burn with the lasting agony, maintaining both together. Each part of Nona's body made its own contribution as the effect reached through her. Bones snapped, fingers burst, teeth shattered, her tongue blistered, her eyes scalded. The torment lasted far longer than Nona could endure. She had no way of knowing how long and could do nothing in its grip. When at last Thurintaxis lifted the device from her spasming stomach, the pain lifted, leaving only nausea and tingling. Nona lay there gasping. The limbs she thought broken looked untouched. The eyes through which she looked were unharmed. Where the harm had touched her, she had expected a charred circle of raw flesh, but the skin there showed just faint impressions of the sigils that had been pressed against it.
"You see?"
Lord Taxus replaced the leather cover and returned the disc to his pocket.
No marks. As if it never happened. Cutting off a nose may not hurt quite as much, but there's a horror to it. Don't you think?
He smiled and let the Noiguan help him to his feet.
I'll be back soon, novice. I've paid more gold than you can possibly imagine for this, and I intend to get my money's worth.
Lano paused, dark eyes still on her.
It's a nice toy Father has, but now it's back in his pocket. You're not in pain any more, are you?
He held up his right hand, the middle two fingers crooked over, as if he couldn't straighten them.
You did this to me.
Nona remembered. Lano had shed his disguise and attacked her on the Abbess's steps, in front of the judge his father owned. She wished she had done more than slice his hand. She wished she had cut his head from his shoulders. She wanted to say it, to spit defiance at him. But pinned on the floor at his feet,
her body still spasming with the aftershocks of the agony that had run through the marrow of her. She lacked the courage, and she hated herself for it. A heartbeat later, with full-blood Hanska swiftness, Lana was leaning over her, his face close to hers, the point of a thin blade inserted into her left nostril. She felt his breath on her lips.
"Before you die, I'll take your fingers one by one, and then your eyes."
He stood, and at the last moment, pulled his knife up through her nose. The sudden burning pain made her cry out. Hot blood spilled across her face, the taste of it filling her mouth.
"Back soon?"
A grin, and Lano hastened after his father. Nona lay helpless and shaking for a long time after the last of the lightless left her cell. She hunched around herself, soiled and weak, and made no move until at last Keot's voice sounded in her skull.
"You have to admire their cruelty."
"They're sick. Evil."
"Those are just words. Thurin's desire is a pure thing. Just because it is at odds with your own does not make it lesser."
"He's a monster. So is Lano." Nona rolled, surprised to find no lingering pain save the burn of her cut nostril. She levered herself to her hands and knees. "Why didn't you pass into him, if you admire him so much?"
"We're bound until death, Nona. But when the old one kills you..."
"The two of you deserve each other." Nona spat, and started to follow her chain hand over hand to the wall.
"So pious. You can't claim to be much different. You have felt that same desire to hurt, motivated by revenge. I found a home in you because of it. Because of how you killed Raymel Taxis."
Nona paused before replying. It was true that part of her had rejoiced in taking Raymel's life. There had been an unholy joy in plunging the knife into him over and over. She had told herself it was for Hesse. But in the moment, it had been an end in and of itself. "People are complicated. We're all made of parts we like and parts we don't." She tugged absently at her chain. "Zol said you were a part of the missing. All of you devils. Parts they didn't want any more." It was Keot's turn to fall silent. He went so quiet while Nona returned to working at the chain pin that she wondered if he might have left entirely. An hour later, she abandoned the chain to let her muscles recover their speed. Her mind returned to the agony Thurin Taxis had inflicted, and to the threat of his return. The wound on her nose still throbbed and ached. So much hurt for so little a thing. She tried to distract herself. "What's Kettle up to?" Nona couldn't understand how the nun could be inside the tetragode and have the thread bond between them remain so quiet. Kettle must have joined her when the Taxis Lord had used the harm on her. Nona hoped Kettle hadn't felt the full horror of it. The idea that Kettle might suffer the tortures that Thurin Taxis had planned for her filled Nona with despair. She hadn't thought you could add anything to being tortured that would make it worse. But forcing Kettle to watch and to share the pain, that was worse. Finding her thoughts had once again returned to what awaited her, Nona forced them onto a new path. Clearly Kettle's plan to lie low was working. She only hoped Zol was hidden just as successfully.
"Maybe the nun has run away. The girl from the ice too."
Keot had tired of Nona's efforts against the wall pin, seeming to have abandoned hope and resigned himself to Nona's destruction. His ambitions now lay in the chance that she could at least maim one of the lightless before they secured her for the Taxis Lord's next visit. If she were honest, Nona's own plans didn't extend much beyond that either. For Nona, though,
What followed would end in pain and death. Keot had hopes that Thurantaxis would be his new home once the man finally put an end to Nona. Unable to keep her mind from the Taxis Lord and his plans, Nona returned to her work. Coil, twist. Coil, twist. One effort became the next, each consuming precious time, devouring the gap before Thurantaxis returned from his party. In a pause in which she gathered her strength, Nona tried to imagine what social event could have drawn the Sis into the barren mountains she'd seen through Kettle's eyes. Her imagination failed her, and she returned to her labor. Coil, twist. Coil, twist. She stopped to examine the pin.
It's moved. It turned.
She tried to twist the pin by hand and found no give in it.
Really?
Keot sounded unconvinced. Nona tried again, coiling the chain and twisting. She returned to the pin once more.
It's moved again. I can feel powdered stone on it.
She tried again, first to the left, then the right, before gripping the pin in her fist.
I can almost turn it.
Again to the left, she knelt and seized the chain close to the pin. She yanked to the right, and it shifted minutely, grating against the rock. She repeated the effort, right, left, right, tugging from one side then the other, and suddenly the pin came free, dangling from the end of the chain in her hand. Impossible! A miracle! Nona stood, panting. She held the chain taut against her hip, the length of it running up from her ankle.
What now?
Keot asked. It was a good question, and one for which Nona had no answer. A key rattled in the lock.
Another trick!
Keot howled.
Like the knife, they were watching, waiting.
The cell door began to open, and suddenly Nona had her answer to, what now? Now, I kill as many of them as I can, before they get me. Chapter 34. Nona swung her leg, flailing the chain, getting the feel of it. In the convent, the novice's game of step involved a rope looped around an ankle with a block of wood at the far end. The game was to spin it around one ankle while stepping over the rope with the other leg each time it came around. Naturally, the novices most keen on earning the red also made a fight of it. The first lightless through the door had a club raised above his head, a 2-foot staff that Nona would struggle to close her hand around. She lashed out with her foot, and the chain followed, snapping out to its full length. The last 2 links hit the lightless between the eyes, breaking his forehead. He collapsed to his knees and toppled to the floor, face first. 3 lightless stood around the doorway behind the fallen man, black silhouettes against the faint candlelight in the hall. Darkness bloomed around them like ink in water, and Nona stood blind in her cell. She dived aside.
You have to let me see, or we're done for.
Trying!
Keot's voice rose to a roar, echoing in her skull. Where he spread from her collarbone towards her neck, it felt like the fresh brand of a hot iron. The devil knifed deep into the flesh of her neck to gain distance from the sigil-cut metal, and forced a path beneath the collar. Once past it, he poured upwards into her eyes. Nona saw a club swinging down and jerked her head back with no time to spare. The weapon's end scraped her cheek. 2 other lightless were coming forward, drifting to either side. More in the doorway, dragging the dead man aside. Keot's vision painted all the walls in fire tones, and the lightless themselves as black-skinned, wearing robes of pale, shifting silver. Nona, having evaded the club, punched the man in the eye. She swung her leg, wrapping the chain around his ankles, then stepped away, yanking his feet from under him. He fell heavily on his back.
Great, now you have an anchor.
Nona ignored Keot. She swayed out of the path of another descending club and elbowed the woman wielding it in the throat. The man attacking simultaneously from the other side swung horizontally. Nona kicked his wrist, sending his club flying. None of the Lightless so far had much more than a touch of Hunska blood, and they proved easy work. The man on the floor in front of Nona kicked loose of the chain and started to rise. As he did so, a Neuguin flitted across the doorway, releasing with a crack of the wrist a spreading cloud of needles. Kiot's sight painted them as a score or more of glowing red dashes in the enchanted dark. Nona turned side-on to minimize the target she presented and dove to the left. Hunska can't fall faster than anyone else. A Hunska can rise faster, driven by swift muscles, but with the needles centered on her torso, Nona couldn't jump clear without first crouching.
Think! It's a puzzle!
Nona saw the needles, envisioned their lines of flight, saw the voids between them. If she was fast enough, she could adopt a shape that would evade many of them, but no contortion would permit all the needles to pass her by. She fell, twisting, flexing her knees to allow one of the widest spread needles passage beneath them. Still, five needles would hit her square on, with perhaps three more that might catch her. The tatters of her smock wouldn't slow them. The needles closed half the distance as Nona swept her arms up. She deflected the first on the wristband of her right hand. Her enemy had provided her armor. She knocked aside another with the back of that hand and stopped two more against the metal of her left wristband. The fifth, she let hit her in the throat. It bounced off her collar. Was the Neuguin Talatha? Nona hoped so. The assassin had stalked her for years and finally captured her for Thurin Taxis's demented pleasures. If Nona had to fight a Neuguin, she would rather it be the one she hated. Nona hit the ground awkwardly. A bruising impact, her hands instantly hunting to see if she had been stuck by any of the other needles. Nothing. She rolled, kicking the Lightless she had tripped. The blow landed between his legs while still rising, and he lost all interest in continuing to get up. The Lightless that Nona had disarmed now drew his knife rather than chase his club. Nona hauled herself around and up him, using his body to shield her from any further attacks from the doorway. The man hardly moved to stop her, mired in the moment as he was. She brought her elbow down in an overhead blow, hammering into the base of his neck. He started to fall. The Neuguin came in fast, knives in hand, amid billowing darkness that even registered on Kiot's sight like swirls of mist. Nona stepped around the falling man to meet the assassin, tugging the knife from the Lightless's hand as he dropped, and circled her ankle, swinging the chain towards the assassin's legs. The Neuguin, whose shape hinted at female, leapt over the chain's arc. Nona slowed the whirl to the limit her body allowed, exhausted as it was from constant efforts to free the wall pin. The Neuguin came straight on without hesitation, stabbing both her blades towards Nona's chest. Nona turned the first on her stolen dagger, and the other on her wristband, struggling not to let it slide off and gash her arm. They slipped past each other and separated.
No cross knives!
Kiot was right. Talatha had been wearing a bandolier of cross knives. This Neuguin had none. Nona threw herself forward, still furious. Zol would have been coldly clinical. Kettle fought in the Serenity Trance, but Tarkak's ice spear had been the one to see Nona's true nature reflecting his own. Rage drove them both at such times, and only by embracing that rising fury could they approach perfection. The clash of metal on metal punctuated the brief exchange that followed, as rapid a tempo as any drummer could beat. The Neuguin's attack left no time for thought. Nona sank into instinct, letting her muscles lead by memory. Once she slashed across the woman's torso, finding her blade unable to cut what lay beneath. Once the Neuguin's thrust came too close as Nona twisted and scored a burning line across her upper arm. Nona found herself pitted against a better knife fighter, but she was a beat faster. She broke from their sharp engagement, pivoting on one heel, throwing her torso towards the floor and bringing her other leg up in a kick towards the woman's face, trailing chain. The Neuguin snapped back away from the kick, but the chain slammed across her mouth and cheek. Nona went into a roll and came up onto her feet. The Noiguan staggered back towards the doorway. The black skin across her face took the chain's force, but the shock of the impact still rattled her brain. Behind her, two lightless took off running down the corridor. Nona followed the assassin, knocking aside the dagger thrown at her. They met in the doorway, one knife each now. Nona kicked at the Noiguan's offhand, stopping her attempt to pull some new weapon or poison from her belt. They fainted, jabbed, slashed. Kiot raging behind Nona's eyes, howling for blood. The Noiguan seemed to have gone on the defensive, maybe still recovering from the blow to her head. Nona reminded herself that the Noiguan was the better knife fighter, and had only to wait for her to tire and slow. Also, the cut on her arm had started to burn, more than a cut in the heat of combat should. The Noiguan's knife had blade venom on it. Not useful in the scant seconds of a Hunska fight, but if she slowed things down and drew them out, the venom would do her work for her. Nona launched herself, releasing every piece of the rage and frustration that had built inside her since her capture and before, since her flight from Sweet Mercy. She slid through the air, knife angled for the Noiguan's heart, the other hand coming forward too. The Noiguan, knowing her center was protected by the armor that had stopped Nona's earlier slash, focused on driving her blade at Nona's chest. At the last fragment of a second, as her knife point drove under the Noiguan's blade, Nona angled it upward and tore a furrow from the base of the woman's palm, down through veins, arteries, and tendons, towards the crook of her elbow. Her other hand caught the Noiguan's wrist before the blood had even begun to squirt, and pushed it up so that her thrust cleared Nona's shoulder by a hair. Nona's own knife thrust carried on, and hammered uselessly against the black skin beneath the assassin's jacket. The pair of them went down together, Nona on top as they spilled out into the corridor. She dashed the Noiguan's blade from her injured hand, sliding over her to control the other arm with both legs. The Noiguan hammered her knees up into Nona's side. The white pain of breaking ribs threatened to take her consciousness, but Nona hung on, cursing. She reached down to cut the arteries in the woman's thigh. The Noiguan thrashed, but Nona shifted her weight to keep her pinned. One surge nearly flipped her off, and then the assassin's strength was spent, pooled in crimson around her. At the far end of the corridor, the heavy door slammed, and a key turned in the lock. The fight had taken only the time required for the two lightless to run the length of the passage. Nona pushed herself clear and made an end of her enemy, cutting first the black skin's straps, then the pale throat revealed as she lifted it. The assassin made no cry, only gargled on her blood, then stiffened and went limp. Painfully, Nona got to her feet. Her vision was blurred, her body weighed three times what it ought to, and her breath came labored.
"You are poisoned."
"I know." It didn't really seem important.
"Do something about it."
"I didn't know you cared."
"If you die here, I have nowhere to go."
"I might like you more if you were less honest." Nona felt herself floating up, out of her body.
"Nona!"
Almost with regret, she fought the sensation. Inch by hard-won inch, she clawed her way back into her heavy, painful flesh and found herself kneeling beside the Noiguan, knees in the blood pool. She began cutting open the woman's leather tunic. A score or more steel vials with glass liners studded the garment's interior, arranged in a row of tight little pockets, all identical, marked with raised symbols that meant nothing to her. Nona took the only one that stood out, being larger than the others, which were all the size of half her little finger. She worked the stopper free and sniffed from a distance. "Thought so."
"The cure?"
Nona tried to laugh and ended up coughing, nearly spilling the contents. "No." She held her wristband up and dribbled liquid from the vial into the lock. Immediately it started to smoke, and the air filled with acrid fumes that set Nona coughing again. She tried to open the band but found it still locked. She dripped more acid in. The lock fizzed and bubbled. The metal protested, and then gave.